You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it's everyone's favorite bucket of sexiness, Drew Gasparini, and you're listening to Now We're Talking, the podcast that is single-handedly reversing climate change. I'm very excited about our guest for this episode. He is a two-time Tony Award nominee. He's a writer, a comedic speedball, and has one of the greatest asses in show business. Beyond that, he's my best friend, my writing partner, one of the lovable morons, and one of my favorite brains to riff with. Small factoid, if you say his name three times, he will come out of your toilet and give your tush a little smooch. But don't take my word for it. I'm so excited he was able to join me on this podcast today. I love him. You love him. Ladies and gentlemen, now we're talking with my best bud, Alex Brightman.
Hello! I'm here with Alex Brightman.
Hello, I'm Alex Brightman.
This is Alex Brightman.
Hello,
Alex, say hello.
Hey.
Hello. This is a 45-minute podcast of us saying hello to each other.
I just wanted to see how many times I can cut right in. Hey, hello.
Hello. Hi. Oh, yes. Okay, podcast over. Thanks for doing this, man. I know you're a busy boy, and it means a lot that you took the time to do this. I feel like I coaxed you in on accident.
I'm never too busy for you.
That is untrue by a lot. First of all, a lot of people who are going to be listening to this have an understanding that you and I are friends. It's a gross byproduct of my life, but it's a wonderful addition to yours, I think.
It's fantastic for me.
Have you benefited from being my friend? That makes me happy. I feel like maybe that hasn't been the case.
No, absolutely. Have
I ever let you down as a friend?
Yeah.
No, that's good.
But what friendship, who hasn't?
Well, I don't know. I would go.
It's complete falsity and a fallacy if anybody's ever answered that question in the negative. If they have ever let you down as a friend, no, never. Are you kidding?
Yeah, no. Then they're not really friends.
Well, that's what I think. Have you ever had a fight with your significant other? Have you ever? It's like, sure.
And when people say, "Are you and Alex really best friends?" I go, "Here's how close Alex and I are. He's maybe one of the only friends I have that I've wanted to punch in the face." That to me is
I think that's all right.
That's brotherhood. Yeah. That's, I qualify that as brotherhood at least. We're going to talk about your brother, by the way, just a heads up, because he's a nut. But I want to talk about I want to talk about Melissa first. You just said jokingly, let's talk about the moms and let's talk about your mom. Let's talk about Melissa. Let's talk about your upbringing. I've done this with everybody on this podcast so far, and here's why. I've known you for a decade plus.
Yeah.
I basically don't know jack shit about your entire adolescent. I know like fun stories like the losing your virginity story, which we can definitely poke at here.
It's not made public. It's literally made public on a podcast.
It's theater lore at this point. Fans across the Broadway spectrum have all come out being like, have you heard the Brightman virginity story? But let's go back to childhood, where you were raised. Let's start there and give us a little insight of like what you were like as a kid, because people know who you became. And I think it takes some explaining. So let's go to the top.
The year was 1987.
My man.
I was born in Mountain View, California, in a hospital there. And then I was raised in Saratoga, California, which is near San Jose, which is why I tell people I'm from San Jose, California.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
But I say Saratoga. I used to say Saratoga, and then people go, "Oh, Saratoga, New York," because that's more what people know. There's a Saratoga, New York that is a little more off the brain. So I say San Jose. I've never said San Francisco. I just say I'm 45 minutes south of San Francisco. That's what I would say.
Oh, okay.
If people would ask, like, "Where's that?" Or I'd say I'm 30 minutes east of Santa Cruz.
I just give people my zip code, and I hope that they go do the work themselves.
I just forward
94947.
I just forward them my address, really. I just go, look this up on Google Maps. The house I grew up in now obviously has other owners because my family moved to New York, and so they sold their house, and it looks dreadful. What they've done to the place is...
What did they do to the place?
It just, like, the lawn, like, what used to be a lawn, like, an actual, most of the front of the house was a big lawn and, like, a bush and a driveway that led up to, two huge bay windows. And it was a one-story house. It was, like, a longer, kind of like a house with an ass on it. And,
And you're kind of a house with an ass on it, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. And the lawn, green, not that we kept it, like, amazing, like none of my family was like had a green thumb, but then now it's like all tan bark.
Oh.
With like with like islands of cement things that were like, I guess, meant to look like something, but it it looks like a, it just, I don't know, it looks dreadful. I'm sorry if anyone's
like
listening to that.
Those,
you know,
houses
lives there, but...
No, whoever's listening to this and they live there, get your act together. Fix the front yard. That's atrocious. I used to live in a cul-de-sac and it was like beautiful little lawn, little garden. There was greenery, and then there was one neighbor. It was just a rock garden, lava rock garden, jagged, horrible, just stay off my property garden. That's what it was.
It's that says it's like midlife crisis. That's like the, I can't afford a Ferrari, so I'm going to turn my front lawn into a Zen garden or something.
Yeah, totally.
So I grew up there. Same house until I left for New York. So stayed in one house on Brookview Drive. And it was like a regular old neighborhood, like a very neighborhood street. On the corner was a bus stop. And my upbringing was, I think you're right. I think it does take some explaining about what, but I think it's actually an easier explanation than people would, I maybe guess, is that both my parents are incredibly dry, funny people. But also, like, you know, like as neurotic as I am, and and probably as Jewy.
I've seen the neuroses from Melissa. Alan hides it very well.
I think we all have it though, for sure. I think that it was I can tell you this. I mean, for being 33 years old, I still absolutely have them on my shoulders. That tells you a little bit about the growing up, is that like, it was a, like, what would mom do? What would dad think? What would mom think?
Right.
I think I still have that. So, I didn't have like I had a lot of friends as a kid that they had, like, they weren't latchkey kids, but they just had, a lot of more what seemed like freedom than I did to do, like, after they would just walk around. I had to like ask permission for things and you know.
Were they strict or were they just like protective, or why do you think that is?
I think it was because I don't know. I think it was because I might have been a bit of an asshole. So I think that they was more, I think it was more of a reaction, honestly, to a rambunctious jerk of a kid who was an egotist at an early age.
Sure.
And somebody was very me, spotlight, me. And so I think earlier on than not, I remember them sitting me down when I was young, very young, to have this conversation. Yeah. And I remember them sitting me on their bed in their dressing room. In their I live theater, everybody. Live and bleed theater. They sat me down in their bedroom. And
whenever you had a babysitter, a slip came out of a playbill saying, your parents will be played by.
That's very funny. That's very funny. That's hilarious. They sat me down on their bed, and this is like much younger than I think I'm even giving credit for. They said, you're not going to have any friends if you're a dickhead.
No.
Like,
way.
You're going to stop. You're going to stop having friends because they're.
Wait, how old do you think you were when this happened?
I think I was 10 or 11.
Oh, wow.
But it was because I absolutely was the kind of kid that would look for the next best thing. I was like, the next, if this wasn't any use to me anymore, I moved on. I didn't value friendships for what they were. I valued friendships with who I could benefit from the most.
Like what you got out of the friendship.
Completely.
Basically.
It was not non-mutual. I don't think it was.
So
a lot of
when do you think you'll start taking your parents' advice then?
I don't know. I'm so successful. It's all just worked. So
all of your friends are just crumpled up pieces of paper that you've tossed as last ideas you've had.
I like to think I have grown somewhat.
You definitely have.
Yeah. From that moment, for sure. I mean, it was very. I mean, that was a formative moment. I remember that very vividly. Sitting on our bed, them kneeling in front of me and having this talk about, you don't treat your friends correctly. Like, you are, you're not a nice kid. I was a mean girl. And I was like, the idea of like, I think that I was that. I know that I was that, but it wasn't out of trying to be mean. It never was antagonistic in a way. It never was in a way of like, I'm going to mess with that kid. I was too small to do that. I was too afraid to get hurt. I was really short when I was a kid. And so it never was about making people feel bad. That was never the idea. It was just that I needed to be the most liked.
I certainly suffer from a bit of that myself, and I can relate to everything you're saying, basically, was my whole goal as a kid was to just make sure that I was liked. It didn't matter what the group of friends was. It just mattered that that group at the time enjoyed who I was at the time. And the minute I was liked by another group, I was like, I think I'm going to check that group out. Now yeah. they're my friend.
I think that's right. And I think the thing that has rolled over from that into my adulthood is I still have an enormous anxiety about people liking me. I think that I do. That's a huge part of my life, and a little too much in a way of like, you know, I put on a little bit of like a, I don't care. Sometimes I'm, you know, for like, you know, I'm just doing my thing and I don't care.
You're better at that than most people I know, if I'm being honest.
And that is a skill. I think it was a skill as more of a shield, you know, like how, mm-hmm. how comedians use comedy is typically not because they're funny. It's because they are hiding something. They're sad or whatever. I'm always so concerned about how people think of me, and I'm always so trying to make them like me, whether it's by not saying something or by, if I say something, to profusely explain myself and apologize as to why it might have hurt them.
Right. And that, what a double-edged sword that is. I mean, like that's something that's really good. You want people to like you.
Absolutely.
It's not a bad thing.
I do think
like, that could take over a bit.
It gives me massive anxiety in a way of like, here's a perfect example. This is yesterday when you texted me, are you mad at me?
Oh yeah, this happened.
But it happens all the time. This happens all the time to everybody in my life. And I used to be that person a lot. I used to go, if I sent a text or if I called somebody and they didn't call me back within 2 hours, I'm like, I must have done something.
Right.
I never ever would go to the benign Occam's razor, like they're busy.
Never. Right, right.
It goes straight to what have I done to wrong this person and how can I fix it? I'm already coming up with ideas of how I'm going to like make up for this and I'm trying to, because I just desperately, not because I want to feel, yes, I do. I want to feel better about it.
Sure. Sure.
The minute somebody forgives you, you feel better. And so sometimes when in my life, I felt like that was the immediate goal, not to learn.
Yeah.
Not to learn from my mistake, but to get the forgiveness.
Right.
And I think that is one thing I have now grown from. It's like, I think when I apologize for something, that's where it stops. I need, the apology is the apology. If you forgive me, great. But I am absolutely sorry when I am sorry for something.
And you feel complete in doing your job and doing that. Now it's up to the other person. That's their problem.
It's not completely gone like a weighted vest. I still feel upset if they're like, thank you.
Right.
You know, if they don't say, I accept your apology, I am like, oh, okay. Okay. And I have to like stretch that muscle and be like, just walk away. You've done the thing. And eventually somebody will, you know, accept your apology. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I've never gotten into enormous trouble. You know what I mean? I've never gotten to like any sort of like way where it was like months long, years long type of grudge.
Right.
But it is something I think about daily. I think.
Do you think that, I mean, this is all kind of a byproduct of that one conversation that your parents gave you on the bed when you were a kid, that kind of sat in your brain in such a heavy way that's created this anxiety of,
probably,
you know, your parents fuck us up no matter how you spin it, but like, right. even
they're
when
trying,
they're doing their best,
trying
and
their
that's,
best.
That's a good thing they did. I mean, to be observant of their child and maybe seeing the actions of you know, how he acts with his friends or whatever, to sit him down on the bed and say, listen, kid, this isn't going to be a good life for you if this is your approach here.
It's a it's a better look at an adolescent than it is in an adult, for sure.
Sure.
But I think there's probably a couple of those moments, like those little cornerstone moments that somebody – you feel your feet on the ground for the first time and you're like, oh, I'm here. I'm actually, this isn't a game. This isn't a play. Like I've hurt somebody. I've made somebody feel bad and I'm feeling it too.
And it took me killing about 9 people to realize that this whole life that we're living is not a game. I thought I was getting points for every death, but apparently that's not it. I should be in prison right now.
It's the only way I can feel anymore, man.
Oh my God.
once my knife leaves its sheath, it has to taste blood before it goes back in.
My knife leaves its sheath.
Yeah.
Its little leather sheath.
Yeah.
When you had a talk like this, you say your parents, you say there was an involvement of both parents. They sat you on the bed. They had this talk with you.
Yeah.
My prediction, and you tell me if I'm accurate here.
Right.
I think you know what I'm going to get. Okay. it was more Melissa doing the heavy lifting in terms of the conversation.
Yeah. My, my mom was certainly, is still certainly more of the like get in there one, like the one that sort of, that's the first line of defense. It's sort of like, I don't care if it's going to hurt your feelings. This is what's, this is the point I'm making.
Yeah.
My dad was on my mom's side 100%. So they never, what I never saw typically was any sort of disparity between the two. It was just the amount of emotion that came behind one or the other. My dad was typically, when we were younger, my brother would, we sort of like, he sort of like was the caveman. He was like, he would always cave. Like, like if my mom, if my brother was like, can we get Jack in the Box for dinner? And my mom was like, no, not like ask your dad. No.
Yeah.
Jesse would go to my dad and go, can we get Jack in the Box for dinner? And my dad would go, what did mom say? And Jesse would say, mom said no, but like, you know, come on. And then my dad would say, my brother and my dad's relationship could be summed up like this. If my dad told my brother, I'll think about it in the beginning of the day, my brother will have found a way to make my dad believe he promised him it
by the end of the day. That's amazing. That's amazing.
And so that would be, became kind of more like, and there is that sort of thing when the mom finds out and it's like, Alan,
like, your brother could be a cult leader. I mean, that's your brother's been gaslighting your parents for years.
He was good at it. He's a good businessman too. He's a good, he was a marketing strategist. And so it sort of, you know, it all fits. He's good with dealing with clients. He's good. He's
your brother to me is the kind of guy who, like, we've never seen him do it, but it would be the least amount surprising if he just arrived somewhere out of a helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if he just, sure. You know what I mean? If he came to one of your opening nights, but his entrance was the big entrance in a helicopter, he'd be like, oh, what up, Jesse? Like, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
And his explanation would be like, it's a client, so I got to use it. It wouldn't be right. A big deal. It would be like, oh, yeah, I just needed, I was going to be late if I didn't take the helicopter. But, he's one of those people that is... I've said this forever, tongue in cheek, but genuinely, for years and years and years, he was the person I like absolutely wanted to grow up to be, because he is kind of like your brother a little bit. The idea of like, even though your brother's older, my brother's younger.
Yeah. Still very close in age. I mean,
the age difference is very similar, but always seemed like he knew what was going on. Like, he knew what he was doing. And I think that because he wasn't an artist necessarily, he did shows and stuff together, but I think his brain was more like, he was really forward thinking about like school, college, business, like, you know, the life, you know, sort of that boiler.
Logical choices.
Very logical choices. And he's really smart. He was genuinely like, you know, grades wise, like that was the disparity. Like, I think I was okay in school, but he was smart. I didn't care. I wasn't really focused in that way.
Right.
My grades were good because they had to be. So I would cram my special skill is memorization, which helps me now, but like, it really helped when I procrastinated for a chemistry exam and then just needed to just get it done.
You just said the word chemistry and I grew 9 more hemorrhoids because like even thinking about school or homework or anything, I have immense anxiety because of that very reason. I was compared. This is here. You had a younger brother. I had an older brother. Imagine going to a class that he had the teacher the year before, and now I'm the student.
Yeah.
And I'm such a letdown to them because Danny was such a golden boy in terms of his scholastic prowess. And I was like, can I bring my guitar into class?
Yeah, like, anyway, I was Wonderwall.
Tuning in the back, real, you know.
Yeah.
What'd you say while the teachers.
What'd you say about chemistry? What's that?
Bring, 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 bring. Bring.
I don't need the tuner. I got a good ear.
I got it.
School was not my thing. School was Jesse's thing, and he was good at it, even though he was massively made fun of when we were younger. And that was a big, like, that was the other, like, the relationship thing with my brother and I.
Yeah.
Was that, and my dad always reminds us of this. My brother used to be very big, obese, like, in a way.
Yeah.
He was very
you
overweight.
Described him to me as circular.
Yeah. A
circle. Yeah. Yeah.
And so he was. I mean, you look at pictures and you're like my mom recently showed me a picture when we were like younger, and my mom even said, she goes, I don't ever remember him looking like that. Like, it was just, you know, you see him every day.
Yeah.
But like, you see a picture and you're like, oh my God.
Oh my God, so that looks like Pac-Man.
He was big, and it was a big, big, big sticking point for him because he was made fun of a lot. And that didn't sit well with me at all. And
you protective?
Very protective. And and to the point where my dad always reminds me of this, I formed a little bit of a gang as a kid to yeah. tell other people that were making fun of him that if you keep making fun of him, we're going to beat you up.
You had goons?
Yeah. Yep. Yes. I mean, that's a real story. That's a totally true story.
I love the idea. You just colored yourself as like a really short guy. And then I see you like with your henchmen, like yeah. pounding a bat into your hand. Like if you ever think about touching Capone's brother ever again,
I was Capone. I was small, but mighty and used my intellect. And also I was faking. I was acting. The idea of I was being like, I will kill you.
Right. That you were faking your toughness because obviously people could kill you.
All they had to do was take one other look at me and be like, that's not going to do anything. Right. He weighs 14 pounds.
Alex was actually on another kid's shoulders wearing a long trench coat. Now that your brother's not a circular human being anymore, but he is balding. Do you feel the need to protect him from adults making fun of him? Because as a person who's balding myself, I feel like that is just as demoralizing and humiliating.
Wait a second. You're balding?
Oh, I haven't shown you?
No, show us. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he's a big boy. He can take care of himself.
he's got helicopters.
He literally is one of the most successful human beings I know. And so he's got a gorgeous family and a beautiful house in New Jersey. And so parts of those things, I aspire to own a house. He does. He was the first one to do a lot of things that adults do before I did them. He still is the guy that I feel like, and I look at him, he sends me pictures of his house. They're doing remodeling things here and there. I'm like, wow, that's an adult. I don't feel like that.
Right.
And when I see that, I'm like, wow, that's like what an adult does.
Yeah, he's more adult than all of us. And you know what? Here's why I don't like your brother. I'm going to tell you right out of the gate. I don't like your brother. This guy, with the success he has, he's got nice ties. He's got nice shoes. He's got nice clothes. He's got a hot wife and a nice house. He does well. Okay. We go to a fucking casino, and the guy can't stop winning more money. Yeah. How? Does this happen to the people who don't need it? No, I don't want to hear. I already know your explanation. I already hate your explanation, but go ahead. Fill us in. Fill the people in.
That's always how it's been. He is.
Oh, with Jesse, you mean? I thought you were going to give me some logical. Well, Drew, gambling is not.
No. Gambling is great. Everyone should gamble. But, no, it's things have always worked out for Jesse. Honestly, the metaphor, not even a metaphor, it's a true story, is that there was a cakewalk at a student carnival that we had mm-hmm. when we were in middle school or elementary school. And there's a cakewalk, 100 circles, in 100 mini circles forming a huge circle, all from 1 to 100.
And was he a circle himself during this cakewalk?
Perhaps.
Okay.
Perhaps. And Jesse would enter the thing. So would I. You walk around to a bunch of music. They stop the music, and whatever number you're on, that's your number. They call it a number. Whoever's standing on that number wins a cake. Yeah. Jesse won twice in the same day, which I think is statistically impossible. I mean, honestly, it's one of those things. It shouldn't have happened. Honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But same thing with any scratch off lottery ticket he's ever bought in his life. Any show lottery, like including the big ones. Like if he entered Wicked when it was hot, he would win. No problem. I wouldn't even be shocked. I'd go, we're going to go see the show tonight because he's going to win.
How annoying.
Yeah, sure. But,
For a guy like me, I have a vengeful spirit. I get, get bent out of shape. I get bent out of shape.
No, not you.
Well, let's go before we hop into like current day. I want to kind of stay in the realm of childhood because people who don't know this, I mean, like your parents basically go to every performance of yours, which is adorable, they're New Yorkers now. They were from the East Coast originally. They've settled back there again. Your brother's in Jersey. You're a Broadway star in New York, but you were all raised in the Bay Area, not far from where I was raised.
Right.
Although we never knew each other back then. I want to ask about a specific skill set that you have. We've talked about this before, but I think it's amazing the way you describe the culinary prowess of Melissa Brightman because you yourself, and there's proof of it on the internet, I believe still, that you're an amazing chef. You're really, you know how to cook. You follow the steps. You make a good steak. You and I shared that cabin in the woods when we were doing that Goodspeed Writers Retreat, and I would come out of bed and smell steak and eggs being cooked. It was amazing. But your mother was not so much that.
No, not even close.
All right. Give us some examples of what you mean.
My brother and I learned how to cook out of pure necessity because we never learned. I mean, my example, there's two examples. One is maybe funner than the other, but first one and the main one is my mom would put frozen chicken breasts right out of the freezer directly onto a hot grill.
And anybody who's listening to this who thinks, well, that's what I do, that's not bad.
You're wrong.
You couldn't be wrong, more wrong.
I mean, you're wrong. It's just not how you cook anything. My mom's favorite flavor is burned. My mom doesn't like seasoning. My mom will go to a steakhouse and ask them not to put any seasoning on the steak, which is like, you know, her prerogative for sure. But like, why would you be going to a fancy, you know what I mean? It's like,
right.
But it's true. She has, and she agree. I mean, she has, it's, and it's not necessarily frustrating. I don't really give a shit, but it made for a lot of like takeout when we were younger, or like very simple meals and things like that. And so I never learned how to cook at all. The other thing my mom made was this thing, like a cheeseburger pie.
Which was
a recipe that I remember liking, but I remember now thinking about it, like, even if I think about the ingredients, it's like a chicken pot pie, but like if a cheeseburger was also in there.
So it's just like a lot of cheese and ground beef and that kind of stuff, like hamburger helper kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's what it sort of ended up feeling like. I think I liked it though, to be quite honest, just to give Melissa Brightman credit where credit is due. The upside to the cooking world of my growing up is that we had a grill and my dad was really good at that. So we had burgers or steaks or anything like that, it was on the grill. No problem if my dad was on board.
That's something, I think the minute you have a kid and you become a dad, even if you've never grilled in your life, that just becomes this new skill you have. I don't know why, but like every father, like my dad hardly, he calls everything he cooks in the kitchen garbage meals, because he just takes whatever's left and somehow makes something. But he's like Bobby Flay when it comes to the grill. He's like a masterful griller. The other day he cooked something. I saw him taking baby bell cheese, you know, the baby bell cheese. And the way he was cutting it, I worry about my old man. The way he was cutting it was with a pair of scissors down the middle, like a disc. And I was like, what are you doing with that? He goes, oh, I'm going to make a salad.
Right. He didn't take the red wax off.
I didn't see, there was no, I think he thought it was a fruit.
Yeah, it'll melt off in my tummy.
What a weird berry this is, he would say. I remember going to your hometown in the Cupertino, San Jose area where you grew up.
You saw the show?
No. Are you talking about Secret Garden when I went to see Secret Garden? That was down in Palo Alto, right? Right. I brought my whole family to that. That was so fun. But no, I'm talking about when you and I took a 3-day train ride.
Yes.
And I really want to talk about this train ride. Sure. First of all, I'll say when we got to, I've never needed a shower worse. I could have been camping for 10 days in the desert and still not needed a shower as bad as after this 3-day train ride along with you. I, was under the impression that if you get a train ticket, that is overnight at any, no matter what, you get a sleeping car. That's what I thought. And you had taken these trains before, these cross country or long travel days of train. And you knew the rigmarole. You bring a neck pillow, you bring a blanket, you bring goods.
A huge bottle of bourbon and you're good.
With which to sleep. Yeah. Well, boy did we throw them back on that train ride. But I don't think I slept one single hour for 3 solid days.
Yeah, you didn't. You told me that. Yeah, I remember that.
My system was just Red Bull, bourbon, and like those microwavable burgers that they sell on an Amtrak. And you can't even imagine what my crotch smelled like when I just lifted the inseam of my pants to take a look. It was like a waft of something.
Unfortunately, I didn't have to imagine it.
No, yeah, we were sitting right next to each other. I would look at you with crazy red cracky veins in my eyes while you were asleep, and I was just staring at you, waiting for it to wake up and keep me company. Do you remember what we did on that train?
We did a lot of things on that train, but we rode a pilot.
That's right. We wrote a pilot. This is going to become part of theater lore forever now, is the day that people discovered they knew that Alex and Drew wrote this pilot. It's clearly not the first thing we wrote together.
No.
But this was around the time that we just started we had a musical under our belts and we were trying for a couple other things. And we thought like our collaborative powers could create the comedy of the century.
You know, wrong.
And I gotta say, like, the premise is A+. The premise is A+, but we created a character named Mumph.
Erwin Mumph.
Erwin Mumph. Tell the listeners what some of Erwin Mumph's characteristics were. And just so everyone knows, this is all real. This is true. This was time spent. We actually spent time thinking this was going to be a show. It wasn't even like a question.
And also cutting other ideas to get to this. So this is what we ended up with, is really what the more important point is. We jettisoned other things away.
Yeah.
We really boiled them down to really what this was. If anyone wants to skip ahead, this will only take 30 seconds. So he's a man of no certain age, though he probably is 90 to 2000 years old. Mm-hmm. He is the sole owner of a duplex in a beautiful Central Park West apartment that is grandfathered at like something ridiculous, like, you know, $1,000 a month, and they can't kick him out. He is violently and vehemently racist, misogynistic, mm-hmm. homophobic, everyphobic. And his only friend is a guy at a, I can't remember his only friend was, and they don't even like each other either. It's two older guys. And then
it was like a deli, right?
It was like a deli, which brings us to his most important character trait, which is his favorite food on the planet is relish.
It's relish.
And he would talk about it all the time. And when he was presented with relish, he would scream relish.
Yes, he would scream the word relish every time he ate relish. This was a character that we thought was worthy of creating a pilot around.
Yep.
What like, a waste of everybody's time.
It was like, yeah, you know, it's George Jefferson, Al Bundy. Yeah. And then you have Erwin Monk. We were thinking it was going to be in that sort of that echelon of character.
What we really created was kind of a makeshift Donald Trump.
A terrible pilot. Oh, yes.
Yeah. And also the worst pilot ever. Although, what was it? You had Dan Jinks read it. And what did he say?
I don't remember exactly what he said. And he was being as nice as he could. But he was like, this is like unreadable. He's like, which is worse. It's like worse than it was worse than being like, you know, this is offensive and I don't like that, whatever. He was just sort of like, I can't even bother with this. It was like, this isn't even like, it's when somebody goes, I can't remember who said this, but someone was like, if you see a movie and you don't like it, it's still a movie, you know? But I think what we made was so bad. I think it actually isn't a pilot.
It's not. It's almost whatever the opposite of a pilot could possibly be.
The thing is, though, what I do teach people, not that this is what this is about, but I do think, because I have everything we've ever written and I've ever written, that you don't throw anything away, because I've used certain jokes or joke premises from that in 100%. Things I've done. I mean, variations on it, but like there's some stuff in there that works. There are some jokes and some, you know, runners that like work, but the entire thing was this like farcical thing that, by the way, goes back to, we're on a train, we haven't slept, we've been drinking, everything we wrote was funny to us, but of course it was.
Yeah, you know? I mean, to tears. Thinking back to that train ride, the experience was awful for the no sleep and smelling the way that we did, or mostly I did, but that experience of writing that pilot was, first of all, I think we learned a lot about writing and without realizing we did, but I could not stop laughing.
Until that point, I had never written I'd never written with somebody as I was writing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I had never done that sort of writer's room, like what if thing, back and forth, which I'm not 100% sure I love, to be quite honest. I don't.
Oh, same here.
And I've tried it a couple of times, and it's very hard to feel like you're waiting for the next thing. Like I when I'm writing on my own, I know that I'm going to have to go back and edit, and it's that not everything I'm writing is solid gold, but I keep writing. Whereas like when you're in a room with other people and you're like, what if he says this? And you think it's good. And someone's like, yeah, that's good. Or what if he says this? And then you're like, okay, here's our next 10 minutes talking about whether it's this line or this line.
I
don't love the stuttering process of like that.
No, it slows things down, but like the laughs in the room are always kind of worth the experience for me. And I think that maybe that experience taught us both that, I think it's better when we both go back to our own brains and then reconnect afterwards. Because I mean, everything else we've ever written was like, let's have the idea, and then you go do your thing, and then I go do my thing, and then we kind of bring it back together.
Why I think it works that when a number of different writing partnerships, but I think that what we do best and what we discovered that didn't work on that and on a couple of things is we are both really good editors, but we need something to edit.
Yeah.
And I think that it's like, meaning later, not editors in the room when it's happening, but like, let's see all the material and let's carve it down. I think that's something that you and I,
we're big proponents of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
And killing your darling, not being so hyper precious about everything you're writing.
And 100%.
That's what I think is what I found. When we work the best, that is the thing that is when it's working the best, I find that it's out of the editing process of going, does this need to be here? Could this be a song? Does that? And it seems to get very rhythmic.
I have a question for you about, and again, I don't want to make this the podcast or like what the theme is here. It's not about our collaboration. It's not about anything in particular. It's just about you. So my question is, you're musical. I mean, like you're downright musical. You've got everyone knows that you're an insane singer, and you actually have some musicality in terms of approaching an instrument and figuring chords out, stuff like that.
You also
have a knack for storytelling. You and I are collaborating on lyrics for this other project, The Whipping Boy. So I know that lyrics are a part of your scheme as well. How come you have never done the songwriting avenue?
Honestly.
Your songwriter friends are broke is you saw that and you were like, no, that's not for me.
This business model simply doesn't make sense. there's so much risk and no reward as I go back into auditioning for musical theater as if that's like, you know,
yeah.
I want something that's a sure thing, musical theater. To be truthfully honest, the answer is, I don't know. I mean, I've never really had a yen to do it. I've never had been inspired to write a song, truthfully.
Yeah.
Like I've never had like anything that inspires me. The next thought isn't I have to write a song. If anything, it's been nothing. I'm inspired, I have chills, and then I just move on with my life. And then now it's more like if something I see inspires me, it does filter into my brain as more storytelling than it does song. Oh, this is an interesting moment for such and such, or this could be an interesting start to a TV show or a movie or something or a play. It never comes out in the way, just because it never did.
Sure.
You know, I wrote a couple songs when I played guitar when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I wrote a couple songs. I was in a band and I wrote.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. So cool.
What was the name of the band?
We had a couple names because we couldn't decide. So we kept having to re-announce what we were.
Oh my god, the re-announce every concert was a debut of a new band. Different name.
I remember one of them, and then just from the title of the band you'll already know like what music I was listening to. One of them, the band was called a Cloven Heart.
Oh Jesus.
I know, we were trying to think of another word for broken.
Yeah, for, no, this is
but I don't think we actually even used that word properly, to be quite honest. And then one of them was, we just literally picked like three words. And so we were called drive like down,
Drive like down,
drive like down, which actually, after I said it a number of times, I was like, this sounds like a band that would be a band name. And I was like, let's do that. That I think we ended up with. And then I think the only other one we had was called Skyjack.
Yeah. Skyjack's fun.
Skyjack is the name of a crane company. And I saw it when I was walking around and I was like, that's a cool band name. So
in eighth grade, I had a band called Primary Paradise. And then I heard the talent show audience chant PP. And I didn't like that. That's immediately what we were known as was PP.
I really honestly enjoyed, I was in a band. I still talk to my friend, Brian Chase, who's from high school. Was in the band, and shout out to Brian Chase. And we talk about it because it was like kind of it was every day or every other day going to his garage and legitimately writing songs and playing them. And it was the first time I was like, oh, this is a real, like, this is a thing. Like, we're actually doing this. And I played some guitar. I played rhythm guitar too, I guess. And sang, obviously. And then every once in a while I would front the band, you know, New Found Glory style. And
so cool.
Shout out to New Found Glory for sure. Sponsored. Hashtag New Found Glory. And
we'll plug their new album here.
And then things went exactly how you think they did. High school ended and I went to college and that was it. And it wasn't like we broke up. It wasn't like there was a big deal. I think actually I did end up like leaving. Like I was like, I was just not committed enough, or I didn't commit. And they found another lead singer who was like a, like a peripheral buddy of mine. So I think they ended up sort of like, that was the band.
After high school, college.
No. I think it was more. I think before high school even ended, I think I wasn't a part of it anymore. Dramatic. It was just more like, I'm doing theater. I don't have time.
I think it's badass when kids like start a band in high school. I think it's like so fun and gutsy and expressive. And instead of doing bands in high school, I was all about a cappella groups. And I started a barbershop quartet, and my brother was the high tenor, and then he graduated and went to college. So my senior year, we held auditions, and this is so depressing. We held auditions in the music room, and zero people showed up to audition. And I was like, oh yeah, we're a high school barbershop quartet. Nobody wants to do this.
I was just about to ask, why do you think nobody showed up?
We were called the Accidentals.
I think you told me that. You've told me that before, and I actually think it's an excellent title for an a cappella group.
I wish I came up with it. That was an Eric Rivera original. Not original. I'm sure he took it from someone. But
I love a cappella. Did that in college. Loved it. Had a great time.
Yes, you did. With F. Michael Haney, correct? He was just on the podcast.
The wonderful, wondrous F. Michael Haney. And it was
he is wondrous.
It was just a time. I legitimately, one of my favorite, if not my favorite thing about college that I had those 2 years. I think being in the Enharmonics at NYU, because of who was there and because of it was a group of people. This goes along with, I think this is why I gravitate now to certain things, is it's a group of people with a work ethic I could really get on board with. I was like, these people come here and it's like, yes, it's social, but there's this undercurrent of like, we're at our job right now. Like there was something cool and interesting about, we're in a club for sure, but it was like, we're going to show people like that we're amazing. And we kind of knew we were good. And then when we went out and did stuff, it was confirmed that we were good. And we were like winning competitions with zero choreography.
Dude,
we were
taking something. Wait, with zero choreography. Is it Glee Club? Yeah. I didn't realize there had to be.
You go to these competitions. We went to MIT. We went to a couple. We traveled to like these national competitions. And we would just enter because we were like, we're good. And we were just a group of people in a line singing and feeling the music. That was it. And every other group was like white gloves and doing that, like that thing where they were like changing positions like they were in like a marching band and doing choreography. So we scored low there is like a choreography category. So we would score low and still just topple these groups because we were so compelling.
Yeah. And the arrangements were amazing. And those were, a lot of them were done by Shayna Taub.
Yeah. Shayna Taub. Hashtag Shayna Taub.
That's right. Shout out to Shayna Taub, who's just one of the most mind blowing songwriters out there right now.
Wildly unsuccessful. Shayna Taub.
Yeah. What a shame. What a shame that she's, what's her biggest thing now? Just only writing with Elton John, The Devil Wears Prada. Yep. Only that. No big deal.
But you knew it when she came into college. She was younger than all of us and better than all of us. So you're sitting there going like, okay, well, I have to step on my game if you know Shayna. And she's one of the reasons why we were so good.
I enjoy settings like that where people around you are so good. This is how I qualify our collaboration, is like when you find someone who isn't just like, oh, this will be a fun ride to go on because like we pal around and it's good. It's a good fun time. It's looking at you and going, oh shit. Did you see the words he just used? Those are words I have to go look up right now. It's time for me. It's time for me to up my game as a writer. And I've always thought that our collaboration and getting our writing out there at all has made me a better writer, because the projects that we choose to collaborate on are a little more challenging than the ones that end up kind of falling in my lap.
But another thing that draws me to people like you, like the Enharmonics, like the, you know, aside from the fact that I'm a nut about specialists, like people that do one thing really well, I just think is incredible. Like one of my favorite documentaries is Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And because it's just, this guy has done the same thing for decade after decade after decade, and he's a master at it. And that fascinates me. So I'm always drawn to people like that because they know everything about their thing. Whereas I kind of know everything about my thing, and, you know, or as much as I can at this point. But the other thing that drew me to you in specifically as far as a writing partner, as far as like wanting to actually make the jump from friends to writing partners, because that's never always going to work. right?
No, that's a risky leap to take.
What I knew was going to be good and what I knew we shared was whatever we wrote was not just personal. We wanted it to get out there and make us money. You know, it was like, it was commercial to us. It was a business to us. Yes, it was artistic. Yes, it still is artistic and it means a lot to us, but in no way did we write something just for us.
Right.
Ever. We always think about an audience. And I think that's how I always have to think. I always think about my audience. Going back to the crux of this conversation about wanting everyone to like me, that has gone into my career. It's like, I always think about who's going to see the thing and always think about pleasing the other. Because it isn't inherently self-serving. You know, it is because it feels good to write and we're like, oh, when we find something that's great, it feels really good. But ultimately, the goal is to make other people feel great.
Right. I think mumph is a good point of like how that was kind of just for us.
Well, we didn't know that. We know that now.
But I think that's the only reason it didn't work out with Mumph is because we wrote it just for us. It's nothing else. It was a perfect pilot. Everyone should go read that.
Fun fact, the pilot and I, Alex, are talking about in this episode is not the only pilot that will never see the light of day. We also wrote a pilot called The Morons, starring me, Alex, F. Michael Haney, and Andrew Kober. Now back with Alex.
When I go to visit you, and like it is a visit. I go up into your dressing room. You and I hang out, pal around, maybe have a beverage and catch up because that's when we find time when you're in a show. Sure. When I'm walking through the crowd of people that has started to congregate in front of the stage door, they know me as your co-writer. They know me as your friend. It is so weird to be known as somebody's friend.
I tell them that beforehand. I go, this guy's coming by.
Let him feel good.
He's wearing a hat. He's balding.
Yeah, and he's wearing a hat because he's insecure of his hair loss.
Say you know him. I prep. Oh yeah, I do a lot of prep work for these hangouts.
Right. You play a couple of my songs before I show up.
And they can be like, this is the one that goes.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, oh man, I'm so flattered. And they ask me to sign an autograph and they'll be like, F. Michael. And you'll pop your head out and you'll be like, no, wrong one. That's the other friend. What is something that you get recognized for that's not necessarily your face on a billboard or Beetlejuice or School of Rock?
A lot of things. It's by virtue of other people. I mean, I'm Ryan Scott Oliver is a big one. Like people
absolutely
they know the 35 millimeter album really well, or they were obsessed with it and they know that from that. But they also like it's kind of a funny story, like because they know that we're writing that together, so they'll talk about that. That is the one that always makes me very happy that people have attached to, because it's like, cool. Like this is not, it's not even really anything that's all that out there in a way that is huge, but it's out there in a way. And the people that latched onto it is excellent. So that's the ones that makes me feel good, of people that have to do a little bit of research to know what it's about and that they like it. And then the only other thing that I'm almost every night at Beetlejuice is Impractical Jokers.
With the big top hat and the whole thing that you did, what was it?
That is the thing I think by the numbers I've been recognized the most for, aside from the thing I'm already at.
Right. That is hysterical. I don't realize how big that show is, but it's giant. It's like a enormous show. Yeah. Enormous. They had a movie. It's just huge. It's just gigantic.
I think that everybody's known for who they are at some point, but then obviously you are known, not you, everybody is known by something else as well. And so I just think by virtue, I think that like the thing about whether it's frustrating or whether it's something that like is that gets in your craw sometimes, that it's just the nature of who you hang out with and what happens to the people around you, you know?
Sure.
And in my friendships, that happens all the time because everybody is in some sort of like, you know, that like water game where you shoot it in the clown's mouth and the horses move a little bit and each one moves a little bit in the carnival game.
Yeah. Yeah. I have nightmares about that game to this day.
That type of thing feels like my life and friendships with people, whether they're extremely close friendships or loose friendships, where either you are on the sideline watching somebody else's career go by in a great way and you're cheering them on.
Yeah.
Or realistically, you're going like, what happened? What's going on with me? Wasn't I just there? I thought I was the horse that was here, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that happens in fits and starts. And depending on the timeline, it just where you fit there, it's either very frustrating, which I sympathize with and can empathize with for sure as a kid up to now. but also I think it's exciting when you realize, when you zoom out a little bit and you go like, this is those kind of wins, which is like, you know, our text thread that we have, you know, with F. Michael and Andrew Kober. It's like a lot of that text thread, I think people would be surprised that a lot of that text thread is not gossip and talking shit, but more celebrating each other for the things we're doing. And I think that it's been that way for such a long time that it's a really nice thing to remember that when you are in the same industry, it really is never about competition. It is, hopefully, and it can be, of course.
Yeah.
And I think in fits and starts with friendships, there is like in friendships, relationships, even in family, I think that there is innate tension about like somebody's doing better than me, which that's relative, you know, that's all relative. But there is that thing where it's like when you zoom out and go, oh, I'm just, if it tips just to that direction, if it always starts to feel like every time it's a win for somebody, it's a loss for me, that's when I think there is something else going on. Whereas when I zoom out, I go, everything's a win, you know? And I don't always.
You and I have talked about this in a lot of ways. And I mean, like, you know, before we wrap up, I got a lot to say now. Hold up. There's something you and I have always discussed, and I've mentioned it now twice with Lily Cooper and with Amber Artolino, who are on the podcast with me. And I've brought this up because when we talk about the industry, people have an idea about it. But when it comes to the friendships within the industry, it is like this. I'm going to paint it exactly like this. We call it the umbrella theory. You and I have talked about this for years, the umbrella theory, which is if Alex is the one, and it's a rainy day, and Alex is the one with the umbrella, we're allowed under that umbrella. Basically, his success is my success. And that's where I really enjoy being known as Alex Brightman's friend. That is overwhelming to me. I love when people acknowledge the morons because it's something that's so silly and it was just ours and I think that's a fun little thing.
Yeah.
When people start saying, what an accomplishment to know Alex Brightman, I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, take one step further out of the puddle you're standing in and maybe see the rest of the globe a little bit.
It's a bit of a miss. I think they're using the wrong word. Is what I think.
I'm sure that's what it is. I still like to put them in their place, the turds on TikTok. But
Follow me on TikTok, by the way.
Yeah, follow me on TikTok. It's great content. But I will call you out. I mean this from the bottom of my heart in terms of our friendship. I do mean that when I say you are so close to me based purely just in the last 10 years of what we've each gone through. You've had my back in many ways. I've had your back in many ways. I've watched your rise in your career. I've watched the little dips. You've watched the rise in my career. You've watched the giant, vast chasms. but no matter what, there is a bond between us that I feel in the best way I could possibly say, very stuck with. I love being stuck with Alex Brightman. And a best example of that, I might cry even talking about COVID,
before you talk about it, can I just, because I'm going to forget, and it's the same thing, you're not going to lose it, is that that's, you just hit it on the head. After all the stuff we're writing and career and all that kind of stuff, that matters, and it does, I think, but I put it in quotes, but it matters. It matters, sure. But when push comes to shove, when we hang out, strictly to hang out, in my opinion, a lot of that falls away and friendship does supersede it, and it's just fun to hang.
I mean,
and
the last time we hung out was like the silliest, most fun time I've had in 2020. Yeah.
And so that's like, I think what the other like thing people, me, I think, but I think other people forget is that like, you know, when you hang out with somebody who's in the industry, who's your friend, you don't always have to be talking about the things you're doing or that you're doing better than the other person or believe that you are or aren't. I just think that you can just be friends taking the career aspect out of the way. And I like that when we can hang out and do that and talk shit or whatever. But like, it's nice to know that that's why when a friendship isn't working, that friendship part goes away and it's just the competition, which I think is weird. When it supersedes, I think it is nice. Anyway, continue.
I agree. Your diversion took the tears right out of my eyes. But I want to say that like there was one moment, and it was, I would never expect anything of you. And I don't, you know, I expect whatever friendship things come with friendship. But when I was playing, you were down in DC doing a contract. You were doing Nick Blamire's show, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And this is in 2015, 2016, I forget. Yeah. But I was doing Lincoln Center. I was asked to do a concert at Lincoln Center, and you surprised me by coming up to do the show.
Yeah.
And that, maybe I will cry.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal, but you recognized that it was a big deal for me, and you, as a friend, took the effort to get on a bus and or rent a car.
I rented a car,
and it got towed. I mean, like the whole thing sucked on your end, but you did it for me. Really, you did it for me, and it meant the world to me. And it was just it's how I felt being the friend who before Beetlejuice went to Broadway, and I was in D.C. and I was having dinner with your parents and your brother before the show. I just felt like I was doing what any brother would do and go support my brother. And I love you always, Alex. I'm always going to love you. You're one of my best friends forever and ever. I've never laughed harder with any individual in my life. And
that's
I don't see
sure.
that changing yeah, ever. You
sure.
and I will always have that. So
I want to say two things. Before,
yes, please.
They're both compliments. One, the way you and I laugh with everybody. I like to laugh with people and whatever. I've heard it. This is the way it's described when you and I are hanging out laughing is other people say it's like they have their own language. It's like that.
Yeah.
They're laughing at things that I'm not even comprehending what it is. Like it's right. like that's one. Two, you mentioned DC when you're at my parents. My parents just talked about this the other day. And I think you should know this because it was behind your back. They said, Drew is the only person other than maybe me, I guess, because they've seen me do it. They go, Drew has, when he walks into any sort of conversation, he came to dinner with people he's met once or twice before, maybe within 30 seconds, he was part of that table. And it's just something you do so well. And it's something that is something I absolutely don't do well.
No, you do it well when you have to. I have seen you do it well.
When I don't have to, though, it is a rough go.
I've seen that too.
Me sitting at one end of the booth going, when are we getting out of here? Yes. Who are these people?
That's a very nice thing for your parents to say.
It's true.
Alex Brightman, thank you so much for taking the time, dude. I hate you. Bye.
I love you, buddy.
Love you too, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Now We're Talking with me, Drew Gasparini. Now We're Talking is a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. You can find out more about me and this podcast at bpn.fm/Now We're Talking and on Instagram at Drew Gasparini. Special thanks to our clever little devil guest, Alex Brightman, and to all of you listeners for tuning in. Make sure to subscribe and rate this podcast wherever you stream your podcast, and keep tuning in for more amazing guests. Before I go, I just want to say, if there's one slice of pizza left, don't be a dick. Ask if anyone wants it before you take it.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.